This is episode 195, recorded February 3rd, 2014.
Indeed it is.
Why, yes. Yes, it is.
So welcome, Aquarimaxers, to episode 195. I hope you're enjoying it so far, even though you haven't really had time to.
During your stay in episode 195, please keep your seatbelt fastened, even when the seatbelt sign is not on, and in case of emergency, the exits are to your right and your left and in front of you and in back of you and wherever the little red X on whatever device you're listening to is.
Wow. Okay. So, okay. Who we got up? He got up on the queue today.
We have you.
Me?
You. You have something to say to us.
Oh, nice.
I think you have, in fact, two things.
No.
To say to us.
Hello, folks. Were those the two?
No.
Oh.
That was not even one of them.
Oh, there's hello, and then there's folks.
I know, but those were not the two. That was not even one of the two.
Okay.
Okay.
What else we got?
Tony in New York and Dr. Bob on the North Shore of Boston. Uh-huh. North Shore Bob.
North Shore Bob, yes.
Yes, yes.
Okay, cool.
Would you like to go first?
Sure.
Tell us.
I would like to go first. Okay. I had some pygmy quarries, pygmy corydoras catfish, right? The little wee tiny ones that top out at about an inch long, if you're being generous.
Okay.
They're small. Had them in this 20-gallon tank right over here.
And yes, you did.
Didn't get to see them very often.
No, they hid.
Once in a while in the morning when the lights would come on, they'd school around and stuff, and it was cool. But generally, you just couldn't see them. It wasn't very fun. I thought, hey, we need to do something about that. So I moved them to a 5-gallon tank in my office that has a lot of Java moss in it. And guess what?
Do you see them now?
They're zipping around all over the place all the time.
Oh, good.
At least a lot more often. And I'm hoping they'll spawn in there. The Java moss should be helpful for that. So I'll keep you apprised.
Okay.
On how it goes. But anyway, I just wanted to say that because sometimes, it's not often that a tank can be too big, but once in a while it can. I mean, I've heard of people keeping those in huge tanks when they keep giant schools in, like 60 of them.
Wow. You know?
And it works because
there's
a big
so
school
many of
and
them.
They feel happy and comfortable. But I only have like 8 of them in there. And so maybe that particular setup I had them in before was not as suitable as the one I have now.
Well, I'm glad they're happier.
Yeah, they seem to be.
Okay.
So we'll see how that goes. The next thing I'd like to say.
Yes, you were going to tell us about how you got rid of, in the grindleworm culture, you had some nasty little flies that are called phorid flies, but it's with a PH, and really I think they should just be pahorid.
Pahorid, I kind of like that.
Yes, or just leave the P silent and just call them horrid flies, because we don't like them.
We should talk about them just a wee bit.
Okay, tell us about the horridity and the horridness and the horror.
Of the phorid flies?
Of the phorid flies.
Okay. Well, phorid flies are superficially a bit similar to fruit flies. They look kind of like them. About the same size, but they prefer to run rather than fly. You know, if you disturb a fruit fly,
it flies.
It'll kind of buzz up into there, and maybe it'll descend back down soon again, but it'll do that. A phorid fly will run instead.
That doesn't seem like a very useful trait for it.
They're fairly fast. And this is the thing. I bought a grindleworm culture not that long ago, because I hadn't had them for a while. It's probably been a couple of years since I had grindle cultures. And anyway, I got another one. And it was really a strong, robust culture. But it had a couple of phorid flies in it.
When you got it?
When I got it. Just as soon as I opened it. And I thought, oh, this is annoying. I don't like phorid flies. So I tried to remove them manually, you know, killed the ones that I saw, and I did that for a few days and so on, and it looked okay. And then later I noticed that there were more, and I was using various methods, mostly just manual removal and really decreasing the feeding of the culture and so on to see if I could get rid of them. It didn't work very well. And so what I finally did, and this was annoying, it was a pain, but it worked. So I got I took the culture, removed with a cotton swab as many worms, grindleworms, as I could, and put them in a container of dechlorinated water and let them sit there for about 20 minutes.
Let the worm sit in the water.
Let the worm sit in the water. The rest of the culture I dumped outside, and even though there were grindleworms in there, it was unavoidable. Dumped them outside along with all the forehead flies, rinsed the container out thoroughly, put a little bit of water in the bottom of it, put it in the microwave with the lid on, and cooked it.
So if there were any eggs, forehead fly eggs left, they got cooked.
They got nuked. And then I put new fresh coconut fiber in, and I poured the worms that had been sitting in that water. I sort of swirled it around to try to get rid of all the debris that I could. Debris. I said debris. I didn't mean to say debris. I meant to say debris. Maybe I was thinking of debris that was blowing on me as I was doing this outside. I don't know. But anyway, I poured them into the middle of the coconut fiber there and then fed them a little bit of dog food and closed it up. And guess what? It's been probably, I don't know, 3 weeks?
No flies?
Not a forehead fly in sight.
That's a lovely thing because
they're completely eradicated. So it's rather drastic. You end up having to get rid of a lot of the worms. It's not fun, but hey, it worked. I just like to point that out. So I just wanted to, you know, let everybody know if you have issues like that, which are not terribly uncommon when you're culturing live foods, you get some little pest in it, that's one method that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
I had used a similar method in the past for getting rid of mites in grindleworm cultures, and that worked too,
huh?
Mm-hmm.
That's good. Okay.
Well, let's move on to other Tony. Contributors.
Okay. We've got Tony first. And he sent us an article. He says, I read just today that free-roaming axolotls are no longer being found in their native habitat. I just wanted to give the shout-out to everyone who keeps this amazing animal, because truly you are doing something very special for the species. And he sent the link, so we can put that up.
Mm-hmm.
That's very sad if they're not being... They're not out there anymore.
Well, and the thing is, I looked at the article, and it says that they often do surveys to collect axolotls, right? Mm-hmm. To see what the density is.
See how many of them there are.
And just in the past few years, it's been decreasing rather sharply. And this year was the first time, I guess, that they didn't actually collect any.
Wow.
And they're not sure if there actually are some. But before they would be collecting like thousands of them when they do this particular type of search. And this time they're not getting any at all. And they said maybe when it cools down in the winter, you know, and now it's getting there, that the water gets cooler and they may collect more because they typically do.
Well, why do they think it's gone down so much?
Well, there's pollution, a lot of pollution down there. Some of it is raw sewage that ends up there because, you know, this is an area where they have people who kind of just take areas on the lake where the kind of reed mats, I guess, is how it works. Because the city, the Mexico City, I think it's Mexico City where it is, they had these reed mats that they would build habitations on.
So they're living on top of the lake.
Yeah, kind of floating on these.
And then they just, dump everything in the lake?
And there are people, not everybody does this, of course, but there are people who do that. And it causes problems. There are also invasive species that have been introduced to the lake that compete with the axolotls and conceivably eat their young and that sort of thing.
That's sad.
Yeah.
Axolotls are just so whimsical.
They are. And I think their survival in terms of a captive population is assured. There's a robust population in terms of lab animals and pet animals and things like that.
But they ought to be still out there.
But they ought to be still out there. And there are only a couple of bodies of water where they naturally occurred. So at least this one, they're having issues with that. You know what's really weird, though?
What?
Apparently they have a relative, a close relative, same genus, that lives in saline conditions.
Like brackish? Like, or just straight saltwater, marine water?
I'm not entirely sure what the salinity is exactly, but it's a lot saltier than any amphibian in my understanding.
Did we talk about that last time? That sounds vaguely familiar. Did you tell me that before?
I may have told you that before. I hope we haven't talked about it before.
I don't remember
if
you told me on the air or not.
Anyway, it's very interesting to me.
Where is that? Where are they from?
And that's also in Mexico, but it's a different lake. There's a,
but it's a lake. It's not like the ocean bay or not. Something.
No, there aren't any.
How did the
truly marine
lake get salty?
Well, probably similarly to how Great Salt Lake got salty.
But so like it's
has an inlet, but
it's not connected to the ocean. It doesn't have like a river going back and forth, or it's its own thing, or
probably has rivers or streams going into it, but nothing going out. So the it basically evaporates some of the water, and it keeps, you know, it doesn't have anything to keep it fresh by flowing out. So, fascinating creatures. I do hope they find some out in the wild. Okay, so who do we got next? Thank you, Tony.
We have Dr. Bob from the North Shore of Boston.
Okay.
And he was talking about room temperature again. We were discussing temperature last time. He says, I think you are correct, Russ, to say that when room temperature is 21 degrees Celsius or 70 degrees Fahrenheit, but I would imagine that the average heated room temperature would differ according to the latitude. I would suggest that in our hemisphere, in more northern climes, the average is lower and rises as one moves towards the equator. I took a quick poll of the people I have coming into the office. That was very proactive of you.
Mm-hmm.
And found that most use setback thermostats set at 20 degrees Celsius or 68 degrees Fahrenheit during the day and 16.5 degrees Celsius or 62 Fahrenheit at night. What's a setback thermostat?
It's probably just one that changes...
You can tell change it, like, on a
with
timer
a timer. Like ours is capable of doing something like that. Yeah.
Oh, I don't know how to do that. We should find that out. He says, mine are usually a little cooler at night, as I indicated previously, with my nighttime bedroom temperature at about 15 degrees Celsius. I only say this because it obviously matters greatly to the species you are keeping. According to my research, my micro sunfish will not breed if they have not had winter-like temperatures lower than any of us would keep our houses. In these cases, chillers are needed unless you get a little creative.
I like that phrase.
Hmm. I have a plan for a circulator pump that I could use in the winter that circulates water from the tank through a wall to the outside and back. The circulator system would be used only during the winter, so basically it's pumping the water from the tank out of the house in a... not a tube, what do you call it, like a pipe or something, or
maybe a coil of some coiled pipes or something,
cools off in the outside air and comes back in colder.
Right.
Okay. I am still working on the issue of freeze-ups. My hope is that a sufficient circulated volume might prevent freezing during our few but very possible sub-zero days.
You know, I've read a little bit about that, and it is an interesting method, and it seems like it would be very efficient in terms of the amount of energy you'd have to use to do it, because a chiller is similar to an air conditioner in a way, and therefore takes quite a bit of energy to do.
Yeah, they're pretty expensive.
But if all you're doing is pumping it outside and pumping it back in, you know, you'd probably have it drain outside and then pump back in the house, or vice versa, you know, using gravity for one direction and a pump for the other direction. And it seems like that would
you'd
be a pretty efficient
a
way of cooling
wall.
It off. Yeah.
So you'd have to do some... You'd have to have somebody come in and install pipes through your wall.
There are different ways to do it, too. I mean, some people have... They'll put an insulated piece of, like, a wooden sort of a slat, I guess, that you would put in your window that's insulated. And so you set it in the window with the window cracked open. But when once you put it in there, it blocks everything except for the place where the pipe is going through. People have done things like that. But it seems like that would be really efficient. And, of course, you could only use it in the winter because the summer it wouldn't cool anything off.
Right.
But one thing, like he does say, the freeze-ups could be an issue if
it's
in a place that gets too cold.
Do they have something where you could stop it from circulating on the sub-zero days? Just for those
couple
of days?
You'd probably have to empty the pipes on those days. But you could probably just put a valve in that you could...
Just turn it off?
Yeah, something like that.
So the pipes don't freeze outside?
You'd have to drain it. Yeah.
And if it's that cold outside and they're sitting in front of a window, they'd probably be okay anyways.
Well, you know, I knew someone who had a pond outside, and they said, I was talking to him about it, and they said, I said, do you ever get it? Because it wasn't very deep. It was a koi pond. And I said, do you ever have any problems with freezing? And because this isn't that deep. Or do you overwinter them in a pond indoors or anything? They said, no, we just leave the pond running all... year.
If the pump's on, it keeps it from freezing,
and they said,
right?
The pump is on all year. We never have had it freeze. And this is in Utah, where it gets really cold.
It's really
sub-zero temperatures are very normal, very common.
Well, sub-freezing, anyways.
Well, even, I guess it depends on what you mean by sub-zero. Yeah, we don't get...
Do you mean sub-freezing or sub-zero Fahrenheit?
Yeah, not...
0 Celsius is freezing, right?
Right. We don't get below 0 Fahrenheit around here.
Not usually.
Not usually, but we do
up get... Up in the mountains, probably more. We're down in the valley.
Yeah, floor, yeah. But where we are,
the habitable areas.
And it does get really, really cold and far below freezing.
We do often have weeks where it's, you know, 5 to 10 degrees...
For a week
for
straight.
For a week straight or 2 weeks straight. And
very cold enough so that you'd think that would cause freeze-up issues, but it didn't in this pond. Of course, a pond is not a pipe. It's a very different animal, but
yeah.
It seems like if it's constantly, that water's constantly
being
warmed.
It speed that it's going through.
And I'm sure the speed would affect things. But if the water is constantly being warmed as it goes into the house and then comes back out cold, you know, I don't know if that... A lot of things would probably affect it. Mm-hmm. But an interesting thing to do some more research on.
Yeah.
You know, I thought it would be interesting to do something like that where you have the tubes running underground. Like an earth tube, like the ones that are used for air to cool buildings or warm buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's just basically the tubes are passing under, you know, 3 to 5, 6 feet of ground.
Down to where the temperature is fairly constant.
Temperature is fairly constant. So in the winter, it just makes the temperature more mild all year round. In the winter, it warms it because it's getting close to, you know, 50 or 60 degrees. And in the summer, it cools it because it's getting close to 50 or 60 degrees. What if you could do that with a chiller? You make a chiller where the heat sink is the ground. And you just put those pipes through a chamber underground where it's, you know, always cool. It wouldn't work for his, you know, his micro sunfish, probably, because if it only got to 50 degrees or whatever, it's not cool enough, probably, but it could work for axolotls. You know, it's an interesting thing to think about. I wonder if anybody's done that. Okay, well, let's move on to what he says next.
Oh, he says, another problem I need to consider is tank condensation. I don't think I have to detail the issues one would have there.
No, that is quite a frustrating one to deal with, though. I know a lot of people with vivariums, like dart frog vivariums, have to deal with that issue, but on the other side, where the condensation happens inside the tank.
Instead of outside.
Yeah. But I've heard of it happening on the outside too. And I read an article in Aquarium Fish magazine about a guy, I think he was from Norway.
Mm-hmm.
He set up an aquarium in his house that kept local organisms from Norway, where it's, you know, quite cold. And so he had to keep this tank very cool, and he was running it on a chiller. But in order to combat the condensation, I think he had to build... he had to build an air chamber between the two sheets of, I want to say it was acrylic, I don't remember.
So he kind of built his own tank?
Yeah, where he had this dead air space in between the two, sandwiched between the two sheets of acrylic, I think it was.
So it wouldn't get wet on the
and
outside.
And so, yeah, and it was a very good insulator, and it worked out just fine for him. So, but yeah,
That
definitely could be a problem.
Mm-hmm. He says he has a related question. He says, I know that we need to avoid using copper for our aquariums, but what about other metals? Are there issues with using steel, aluminum, stainless, etc. tubing? I would guess that the salts, even in freshwater aquaria, could cause corrosion problems with some metal tubing.
Well, what Dr. Bob said about the salts definitely makes sense, and acid water can also react with metals, and maybe be even worse in some ways. And there are some exceptions, though. I think, think about this. If I were to open up that filter over there, the axle of the impeller, if that's the correct word, I'm not sure if it's called an axle or not, but basically the shaft, the impeller shaft, is stainless steel.
Okay.
There's really no problem with that. And, of course, if you're using something like steel scissors in the aquarium and you just cut plants and then you take it out, that's fine. That's never been an issue. But here's something. A lot of planted tank people, including myself, have used staples to attach, for example, moss to cork wood.
Don't the staples rust?
And they do eventually rust. But most people who do it just say, you know what? Whatever iron ends up in there, the plants are going to use it. And they seem to.
I guess that's
true. And it doesn't seem to bother the fish at all.
And I guess if it's not a planted tank, you wouldn't use it to attach the plants, so that it wouldn't be in there.
But I've had staples in tanks to, you know, have a cork wall in the back of the aquarium and moss growing on it.
Mm-hmm.
Staple it in, everything's fine. All the fish are happy. Works just totally fine. So I think there are cases where metals are not particularly bad, but I would avoid using things like aluminum or things like that. So I would say the only one I've used really is steel in an aquarium.
So we can't really talk to the other ones.
Can't really talk about the other ones. I know that some of them, like aluminum oxide forms on the outside of it. It kind of makes a protective sort of shell, but it depends on the water, you know, the water chemistry and stuff. And if you change the water chemistry drastically, you can also get that to react with the aluminum oxide, and that can change, you know, how it's available to the water and so on. What could leach into the water.
Okay, well, that's good to keep in mind. He has a question for Mick, too. He says, I was wondering about the raising of axolotls, since I heard that they can be cannibalistic. Do you have to isolate the young at a specific age?
Well, so we can wait for Mick to answer this. So, Mick, go ahead and let us know how that works. But I'll tell you what I've read about it just for now. I can't really say anything very useful because I've never done it. But I've read that if you raise axolotls together from a young age to adulthood, that there is a stage that they go through. During that time, if they are exposed to other axolotls, they will become cannibalistic and they'll nibble on each other. And they really don't ever stop.
Weird.
It's kind of a learned behavior while they're young. But, and this was at that website, what is it called? Biaxolotls.com, I think it might be.
Okay.
.net, something like that. Anyway, if you keep them separate during that impressionable period, then once you put them back together, once that period is over, they will not bite each other.
That's weird, because usually it seems like you have to raise animals
like
together since they're a baby if you want them to not rip each other up, but then you can actually go back and re-put them together after that, and they're fine.
Weird, huh?
That is weird.
So let's see if Mick can confirm or deny that statement.
Mm-hmm.
It's an interesting thing to me.
Okay, well, North Shore Bob says, thanks to South Shore Bob for the suggestion of the Boston Aquarium Society. Unfortunately, my crazy schedule would never allow for the evening trips into the city. This is unfortunate, since this will continue to be a problem with fish clubs reaching new members. I think if fish clubs do not begin to use other means to get together, i.e. video, then they will likely suffer membership attrition.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, that it helps to get alternative methods of meetings for those who, you know, can't make physical appearances and things like that. Good point. Kind of like our live hangout.
Aha! Uh-huh. He says, Russ, you talked about fluorescent bulb life and efficiency over time. What about LED? Do LED strips lose light spectrum with age?
My understanding is that they don't. They maintain the spectrum. Now, they can lose efficacy if, for example, some of them can get hard water stains over the bulbs.
It just kind of makes like a film, and it just doesn't come through as well. It makes a film and
reduces things and makes them less effective. But as long as they're protected from that sort of thing, apparently they do well until they're gone. They don't lose spectrum over time.
That's nice.
Yeah. Kind of nice.
Yeah.
An interesting thing I was reading about, though, they do suffer from a phenomenon that past a certain point, they begin to lose efficiency. The higher the current you put through them, the less efficiency they have in terms of bang for your buck, the more light you get out of it.
I think you lost me on that one.
Okay. Well, basically,
probably everybody else is not lost.
If you have a fairly dim LED light, it's really efficient. But if you try to make a really bright
really
one...
It's really efficient at being dim?
No, it's just for the amount of light you're getting, you're using very low energy.
Okay.
But the brighter you get, the more electricity you have to put in to get a return on the light.
And it ends up not being as efficient.
Not being as efficient.
So is it better to have two dimmer LED bulbs and one brighter one? Will they equal out to the brighter one?
I think it's more about the limitations of, you know, LEDs can only get so bright and still be efficient. But they're still bright enough that we can get some really good ones that are growing, you know, plants and even reef tank photosynthetic organisms and stuff. So maybe it doesn't really matter that much because we can still get that far. We
can still use it.
But they're just not going to be as efficient as the dimmer ones.
Okay. I think that's pretty much it.
Is that about it for today? Yeah. Okay. Well, we're looking forward to our live hangout show on Saturday.
That's only a few days. Does everybody have their instructions? No. Raise your hand if you don't have your instructions and we'll call on you and Matt can... Oh, wait.
What?
Never mind. That won't work. Oh. That was a joke.
Oh.
Sometimes it doesn't work to be a joke either. Okay. Everybody should have their instructions, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
And those of you who are participating live, you know who you are because you've sent emails in and requested
it. You know who you are. And we're watching you.
We'll look forward to setting that up. We've encountered a couple of technical difficulties that we're resolving, hopefully, right now. So we should be ready to go. And it'll be fun. You'll get to see Aquamax in a new dimension.
Yay, 7:30 in the morning dimension.
So.
I told Russ, we're going to have to get up early so I can actually put on some makeup before. No, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I'm going to put on some makeup too.
Do you need some stage makeup?
Yes.
Okay.
Don't want to wash out my cheeks.
No, you've got nice cheeks.
Okay, here we go.
Okay, may the force, I mean.
Oh.
Sorry.
May the what?
Fish!
Be with you.